All we have to do is change the price on one item and we will get more customers. You don't learn that just by standing around. Like, you actually have to ask the people around you who talk to your customers or see the customers or walk the route east instead of the route west into the restaurant, right? All these things come up that you just don't know unless you ask.
Welcome to the Jason Mark Campbell Business Podcast, where we explore what it really takes to sell, lead, and grow a business and ultimately live well. In every episode, we go beyond tactics to discover how entrepreneurs and leaders across different sectors are growing with love, impact, and integrity. Welcome back, everybody, to the show. Very excited about the conversation we're having today. And it's one of the little privileges I get to have as hosting this podcast, getting a chance to speak with incredible people. And right now, tomorrow, actually, from the recording of this episode, me and the team that I'm managing right now are having a strategy session. And I thought, what other conversation could I have with someone who's an absolute genius when it comes to business strategy? He's a former McKinsey partner, small business advocate with a career spanning into corporate strategy, entrepreneurial ventures, and executive leadership. Sri Kaza is joining me. And as you are listening to this, his book, Unconvention, has just released. It's a small business strategy guide that challenges the traditional business thinking and highlight what truly drives entrepreneurial success. Now, we're going to go into some conversations that are going to affect you if you are a small business owner, you're trying to maybe consider getting into business, and we'll actually define exactly what stages that you are considered small versus big in this conversation that we'll talk about. What is the strategies that work for today? Sri, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me on. This is exciting.
Congratulations on the book launch. As we're recording this, I know that you're just on your speaker tour right now. So, like, explain first, what is the life of somebody who's about to release a big book? You're on tour right now. You're bouncing from city to city, hotel to hotel. What's going on right now?
Oh, it's a new world for me because, you know, traditionally I've been an executive who ran companies. I've got a lot of people I'm working for, I think of, and there's just a lot of day-to-day firefighting and leadership. At the moment, I am focusing on me, which is the book, and out there talking about me. It's a very different world to be in when I'm going to, you know, say, hey, these are my ideas and getting out there and selling. It's not my like DNA to go out and self-promote. So going through this, I get it. As a business leader, you've got to go market. You've got to go pitch a value proposition. You've got to connect with your audience and win them over. But when I'm the value proposition or my ideas are the value proposition, it's such a different world because I'll get in, and I was saying earlier in our conversation, yeah, some of it's a lot of work. It's like, you know, I got to get myself ready. I got to be thoughtful about how I'm prepared to open. And what's really the most fun about what I'm doing is actually just the conversation about you, about what you're up to, not about my stuff. So as much as it's exciting and new and different for me, I'm very much out of my comfort zone. And what gets me into my comfort zone is talking about other people's business ideas and what they really want to go do with themselves and their businesses.
Well, this is the first book, right?
Yep, first book.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because most people might assume that, oh, when you're the leader of the organization, the CEO, you're like this self-centered, egocentric person that just talks about themselves. So, hey, stepping into writing your book might be the easiest thing, but maybe I'd ask you to unpack that misconception.
Sure. Look, a lot of times, being the leader does mean it's about me. But I study, you know, being a servant leader, a leader whose role and responsibility in life is to help the team that he's working for achieve what they're aiming to accomplish. And sometimes, though, it does mean take the attention, be the lightning rod, be the shield, or be some kind of, you know, I wouldn't say ego really never helps you be a good leader. But ego, as I've seen it in other places, does help you convey confidence in a vision and shield your team from other things. However, if it's not seen right, if it's not absorbed right, if you're not connecting with your team, and if they're not feeling the benefits of it, it never comes off as good. So I wouldn't go off to say that that's the wrong misconception. It's only usually used by people who are not feeling the benefits of good leadership. But my philosophy and the reason why I struggle with this, hey, this is about me, listen to what I have to say, is that didn't work when I tried it as a business leader, and I had to grow out of that to be a good leader. So here I am like, hey, wait a minute. I don't even like saying, hey, listen to me. I say, I want to hear about you, and I want to hear about what motivates you, what makes you excited, and what brings passion into your world, because what I've learned as a leader is if I understand that, I can help you actually achieve bigger things.
I like that. I want to make sure we're speaking the same language, because one of the things that you speak about in your book is you target and speak to small businesses. And I feel like depending on which stage you're at, and you work for McKinsey, so I'm sure a big business means like a Fortune 500, maybe a Fortune 100. So how do you define a small business in the context of what you teach?
So it is probably better and easier to describe it as the owner-operator business. So this could be a 500-person business. This could be a $100 million business. But for the most part, you know, you're thinking about businesses where you have all of the say and all of the risk as the leader. You don't have a huge number of people around you who have, you know, equity or some kind of stake in the outcomes. They're just there to do their jobs. They want to help you. They're aligned with what you want to achieve, but they're not accountable at the end of it. And so it's kind of one accountable person or maybe a small group of accountable people. And size is more in the eye of the beholder, but I would argue I've worked for a Fortune 50, which was run by the founder. So that organization led through real vision with the same kind of characteristics is possible. It's very rare and doesn't hold together very well and all kinds of conflicts arise in. But even one of my roles after leaving McKinsey, I worked for Tor Hagen, who was the founder of Viking Cruises. And he was basically the owner. And so he's the owner, he's the operator, he's leading it. And it was his vision and it was his purpose and mission that the rest of us kind of got aligned around. And he was able to pull off some amazing things while it was, you know, just under his leadership. So I think small is really, in my definition, is owner operated. Like, if the person who's got all of the accountability is the one who's making the day-to-day decisions, that's small.
Is there like an elimination that you would do even on the lower end of the spectrum? So like, say I'm an independent contractor or I'm self-employed. Do you even consider that small business, or at what point does it become small business?
Oh, absolutely. It's such a powerful way to look at, you know, maybe you don't report as an LLC or anything like that, and all your income is put on some Schedule C or 1099. It's very important, I think, for the independent contractors, the consultants, the lawyers, you know, single shingle practitioners of any number of practices. The small business may be what you think of as just your career, as is what I do. But when you think about it with the framing of I run a business, it has a profit motive, but I have personal motives and I need to run the business with both of those in mind. I have to think about my purpose, not just, hey, I wanted to be independent and make some money, so I started my own law firm or I started to practice law on my own. But you left that law firm because you didn't want to go end up like some of the partners who've kind of drunk themselves to death or working in the office late and all these other kind of negative outcomes of some of the folks who kind of stick with that. Well, if that was your reasoning, if you're here to be independent but also manage your own lifestyle, factor that into how you run your business. And your business doesn't have to run like the other law firms. It can run like a law firm that cares about people's, you know, lifestyle, which is one example of many different ways you can take your personal purpose in your day-to-day life and fold it into how you run your independent business. It's pretty powerful when you see that you actually have a couple of tools to play with to decide on where do I commit to, what kind of risk do I take, what kind of pressure do I have to put on myself. You can be so much more productive when you manage that well.
Yeah. I mean, I've become an independent contractor or self-employed in the sense that I am the main asset. Like, I basically put myself inside of organizations. I drive their leadership teams. I'll run things and kind of take on these projects. But what the person is technically hiring is me, my competencies, me as the asset. But I've been running in structurally LLC. And I know you threw a couple words like 1099s. Those are American entity terms for those who are from the international side. But I've always treated myself like a company so that it gives me a lot more open of thinking, being like, hey, yeah, I should be hiring these people that can help me automate these tasks. I should be looking to, you know, build capacity. And for me, that's always just been the way that I've operated, which gives me a lot more time freedom, giving me a chance to take on more than one client and not just think that the one client is all the business that I do. So I have a lot more freedom. Is that the type of things that you encourage for people to do?
Yeah, well, for sure. I love what you termed yourself as, is you're not just the owner and the operator of the business. You're also the asset of the business, or maybe one of the assets of the business. You know, one of the things I encourage folks to do is you're thinking about your strategy and what you want to be and who you want to serve. You can go and do lots of things, or you can go and fill your plate up with a ton of work. But typically, you see that there's a bottleneck on one of your most important assets. And in your case, it's going to be you. You can only deploy yourself to a certain number of clients over a certain amount of time. And it turns out being productive as an asset isn't the only thing you as the asset have to be doing. You have to be running the business too. Like, you can't just be consulting all the time. You actually have to win your next job. You have to stay organized. You have to actually sharpen your own tools and your toolkit to be able to get out there again and be productive. Can you imagine? If you thought of yourself as a piece of equipment, you need upgrades, right? You need maintenance, right? You have some scheduled downtime, right? There's all of these things that if you thought of yourself as an asset, you might actually manage a little bit better. So it is definitely a piece of the thinking of, I'm not just here to go with the flow. You have to be a little bit more purposeful in making your plans and designing your life. And what you find is, you know, knowing that purpose and then managing around the kind of limitations you've got, you can actually open up so much more. You can do so much more when you get conscious of that.
Well, I do know that purpose is one of the core tenets of what you speak about in your book. And you speak, the whole book is all about being unconventional. So what is it that you're advocating for when it comes to purpose that's different than what most companies are talking about, especially the big ones, that we might be missing the mark here?
Yeah, I think when I laid out these three principles for the small business owner, I liked to recognize, first of all, small business owners don't have a ton of time to do analytics, to do all the processing, to go do surveys and mission statements. It's not what they want to do anyway. They want to focus on creating value for their customers and creating a sustainable business for themselves too. So I like to boil down the thought process that they use into principles instead of a lot of analytical thinking. And then I talk about a lot of business frameworks where when I was a McKinsey consultant, we'd go bring in data, we'd do the surveys, we'd come up with the right answers and say, look, in place of the data, in place of having a well-designed pricing scheme or a well-thought-through operational plan, you're going to have to leverage these principles. One of the principles is purpose. And quickly, the other two, proximity, which is what you know and how close you are to your customer. The other one is positioning. So what makes you different? Why are you special? How do you stay unique? And in some ways, to think about who do you serve and who do you not serve? But then purpose is, why am I here beyond just trying to make a buck? The benefit of purpose in the small business world is that, you know, you don't have this large set of stakeholders who are all looking for profitability or growth. Now, it doesn't mean that you're not there for profitability and growth, but what it means is that you can gain alignment on objectives for the things you want to do that don't have anything to do with profit. Which, if you're in a large business, these work really well when they're profit motivated because everybody understands math. Everybody can walk into a meeting and all agree that, oh, this is going to make us more money. Let's go do it, right? I can walk into a fintech that I'm working with and they're like, oh, hey, if we all just charge our customer, you know, a couple of bucks more here, we're all happy. This all works. It's profit. Let's make the decision. Let's do it and let's get out of the room. Somebody's done some math, say, I'm going to lose a couple of customers, but it doesn't matter. Small business could, if they had all the people, could do the math, go figure out what their price should be, go price it to the absolute max and make sure they leave no penny on the table, and they would be acting like a big business. Now, the problem with that isn't so much that, yeah, you're screwing over your customers, right? Or that, hey, look, this is an unsustainable, like lots of money. It's that you don't take into account why you're even doing the business. And it's different if you're in there as a profit motive, just say, hey, we're going to maximize our profits, return to shareholders, call it a day. Most small business owners are there because they actually like helping their customers. They're there because they want to have an impact. They want to make a difference. And you don't get that by creating value and then taking every last penny of it, right? Now, if you're Uber and you spent billions of dollars building a massive collection of customers and your children waiting and waiting and waiting. Yes, let me take every penny extra that I've earned away from the driver and keep it for myself. And like every penny extra that I can take from my customer's wallet, I'm going to figure out how to take it. That's how they behave. And you're stuck with them. They're massive, whatever, right? A real business owner who cares about his customers, who cares about having impact, wouldn't think that way. They're going to say, well, what I really want are people to be happy about what I'm doing, want to come back, want to tell their friends about this, and are proud to say they're my customer. So they're not out there maximizing the price. They're not out there saying, hey, I'm going to gouge my customer. So I picked this simple set of examples to say that if you were to pick up a book and say, how should I do my pricing? It will tell you to maximize it. And if you were to say, let me go follow these strategies and end up with more money, you might end up with more money. You won't end up with more fulfillment, and you probably won't end up with more customers. And in the end, you may not end up with a business if you try to mimic what the big guys are doing. Instead, you got to design it around yourself.
You know, I find it very interesting, and I love your take on this, because let's take, for example, maybe a more common one would be something like Netflix, right? Like Netflix, at some point, we're all about like sharing is caring, share your password. And that's how you actually get your whole family to be enjoying Netflix. And they kind of dominated the attention, dominated the market share. And then at some point they got together as shareholders. They're like, wow, we could make a whole lot more money if we just stop the sharing and put a bunch of technology to prevent the password sharing and create it a lot less convenience. Now their market value, they made a ton of money. They're starting to charge more. Every streaming company is trying to charge more. But you're also seeing record number of people pirating. And now they're losing a lot of customers. There's zero loyalty to these customers. So like, you probably forget, like you're trying to measure everything, but there's definitely things like brand equity, trust factors that are not being quantified. And is that like the sauce that big businesses are missing here?
Well, I don't want to say any of these big businesses are missing, because if you check their stock prices, I think they're doing just fine.
They're fine, right?
I think though, small businesses can get caught up in trying to mimic that. And you take, for example, loyalty. I like loyalty as a good example, because if you're in a big business, you care about loyalty. You measure loyalty. You look at repeat purchases. You look at retention, how long the subscriber stays. And then you say, hey, let me give away some points, or let me give away some free flights, or do some things to increase loyalty. But let me ask you, the word loyalty to you, does anything about, thanks for giving me a few extra miles, so I'm going to fly your next flight for free, speak to loyalty? No. This is a game. It's a gimmick. They're just trying to drive up more revenue. In fact, loyalty in their mind is repeat purchase. It means how less likely are you to think about somebody else and just spend your money directly with me? This is not how you should think about loyalty if you're a small business. If you are running a business where you have real proximity to your customers and you understand what they care about, loyalty comes from delivering quality, building trust, being there when they need you, caring about them, not gouging them. And when you design your, like, hey, how do I get repeat customers? How do I get people to keep coming back? Or how do I get people to, if it's not a multi-purchase, maybe it's advocacy. So how do I get people who have enjoyed my service to advocate for me? I mean, giving them a points program is not going to do it, right? Going down the path of these bigger businesses, it's not going to do it. You have to go look within and say, what values do I share with these customers or users of mine? How do I get them to understand that I need their help? Maybe it's just an ask, right? Or maybe it's a give that you're going to give them so they come back to you. But whatever it is, it's very different if you start to bring into mind what kind of business you really are, what kind of trust you're really building with your customers.
You know, I'll take a more small example that maybe others can relate, but I do love coffee. And there's a ton of places where they have these little cards that if you stamp 9, you get your 10th one free. And like the level of care that I have about that is so minimal, because all I just want is like a really damn good coffee. And like, I'm the snob. I'm the one that really wants it to be. And I just drink black coffee, so I want it to be like the perfect long black. And there's this one restaurant here. I'm based in Bali, and there's this one restaurant just down the road. And it's like, they have the points, they have discounts. I don't care about that. I go back because every time that this guy who has tattoos, piercings, I know he's going to make me the best coffee, hipster vibe. And every time it's poured perfectly, that's loyalty to me. Like I go back there because they just care so much about making the perfect cup. And I think that speaks to what you're just saying right now. It's like, I don't need a points program, loyalty program. I just need to deliver on the promise.
That's right. I need to be confident in my promise. I need to stick to it. And then, you know, we talked about some of the other principles positioning is a really important principle here. And being different and committing to that difference, right, is actually quite powerful. Now, in some cases, people might feel it's limiting. I want to offer black coffee. It's going to be fantastic. It's going to really be about the beans. And no, I'm not going to have 16 flavors of syrup for my lattes, right? I'll have the espresso machine, but I'm not going to go out there and do, you know, these fraps and these whips, et cetera. Why? Because I care about this way of doing it. Somebody's going to come and tell you, you got like all this foot traffic. You're going to make more money in the afternoon if you sell people ice cream too. You know, fine, listen, don't ignore people, but circle back to like, what makes you unique and special? Why are your core customers coming back? Invest there before you start to invest and let me go get more customers on the fringe who don't understand my differentiation, don't care for my differentiation. Now, that's a tough message, by the way, for a lot of small businesses because they're going to sit there saying, well, I got to grow. I can't just make money off my core business. I do need to consider growth and other options and different things. And, you know, I know that customers want these things. I think that's true. And I'm not saying there's a blanket answer, but so where the other principle comes in is proximity. You know your customers best. You know what their habits are. You know, you don't need a survey. Talk to them, right? You don't need a survey when you understand why they're coming in and what they care about. What you need is to put what they care about into your decision-making. What is it that they need? I'm not as busy as I need to be in the afternoon. What is it that they think what those kinds of folks would want? Or what is it that the people who appreciate my focus areas to be will want at that time? That's a much better way to build your product and growth strategy than getting a survey in or adding products just because other people sell them in the afternoon.
You know, this brings up another example of a restaurant locally, which is there was this restaurant called Avocado Factory, and they were great for making these great breakfasts. And I have a feeling that they were facing this issue because who the hell is going to go and have that breakfast in the afternoon or late at night? So you know what they did? The restaurant is actually two restaurants in one. The Avocado Factory opens till 2 p.m. And then from 2 p.m. till late, it becomes BB52 Burgers, and it's a burger joint. And they're using the same equipment. They just changed the identity and now they've filled up the square footage with more money without diluting their core customers. I thought that was genius.
Right. You come up with a creative solution. You've got a core asset and a brand. And look, your asset's only valuable in the morning, right? Your brand's only there in the morning. And then this asset's underutilized. So to solve it, you don't have to take your positioning and spread it across both time frames. Go come up with a better positioning. You can have two or three businesses. Some of my favorite examples are in restaurants where you're trying to utilize the kitchen, the window. You've probably seen The Bear. The Bear is a fantastic show if you haven't.
I heard of it, haven't seen it. So
The Bear, though, you know, it used to be like an Italian beef sandwich place. And then the chef, Carmi, decides to kind of turn it into a high upscale restaurant, beautiful upscale restaurant. But critically, he has to keep the window open during the day and still sell a lot of the Italian beef because you got this asset, it's Chicago real estate, you spend all this money, but people are only going there at night, right? You're only having Thursday, Friday, Saturday traffic to pay, you know, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day of rent. So open the window, right? Go have the to-go's, totally different brand, totally different food, but you're using the same asset, the kitchen. Fantastic ideas. Like this can be done for people.
So I want to speak about this proximity and positioning. So those two things, I think, obviously go hand in hand because with the proximity, you get a better idea of your positioning. And I'd want to talk about how do you differentiate between good data? Because when you're a small business, you don't have perfect data. You have a lot of imperfect data. And so I'm wondering, how do you filter out noise that could come from a very, I don't know, far non-standardized customer that could bias your positioning, because that one very loud customer that comes in, you think that's what everybody wants, but it's just one outlier, which was the word I was looking for. And even our own personal biases, are those good data points? Do we have to filter it out? What's your thoughts on that?
So your personal biases have shaped the business that you've created to begin with. Don't just kind of blindly be stubborn and believe they're all right. But I do think you should be embracing them. You should be out there. You know, again, I mentioned Tor in my earlier conversation, Tor Hagen, the founder of Viking Cruises. You know, he had some personal biases around what people wanted to experience when they'd go on a cruise. And it was actually very different than the norm. But he found success because he represented a big underrepresented group who wanted specifically, and this is my favorite little side story on it. We were trying to go get tables designed out for the new ocean cruise that we were going to launch. And he only wanted 6 top tables. And this is primarily like a lot of couples are going on these cruises. You know, they're in their 60s and 70s and they're all going on these cruises. And I'm thinking, wouldn't you have like a couple at 2 tops, a little romantic dinner? You know, the look he threw at me when I asked if a pair of 65-year-olds or 75-year-olds would want to have a romantic dinner. He's like, these people have been married for 35 years. They don't want to sit and talk to their wives. They want to talk to other people. And, you know, I didn't know how to handle that. I was like, oh, okay, I guess so. But the reality is he has just a fantastic understanding of his customers and they love it. They love the experience. He's created experience. They love them. So who am I to say, look, if I did a survey and asked them all, hey, do you want to go on this vacation and spend, you know, some of it with just your wife to talk to over dinner, et cetera. Like, there's no dude who's going to fill this thing out and say, no, I don't want to sit there with my wife and talk to her. He's just not going to do it. So can you imagine that you do this survey and you're like, yeah, let's do a bunch more of this 2 top tables. You immediately lose one of the biggest values that he's created with the experience that he insisted on, which was a lot of socialization and people meeting each other with a similar kind of desire to see the world and visit Europe and the different reasons they've come together. It fits and it's a very social environment. You had a hard line. We're not getting rid of that. And you could be influenced by a survey. I would have actually created the survey, showed him why people want this thing. And if he implemented my recommendation, he would have ruined the experience. So look, I can't tell you that your gut's right. I think you need to embrace it. Look around and say, do my customers appreciate it? Right. And you ask, hey, how do I avoid bias? As you talk to more people, you talk to your customers more. You have to go and ask and learn and be open-minded to what you're hearing. You don't have to change, but you have to listen.
So I mentioned earlier that we're doing some strategy meetings in the company I'm working with. We're doing a lot of breathwork certifications and we're creating a movement and getting more people to do some breathwork. Soma Breath is the brand. And one of the key things we're trying to do is really get closer to the customer. And I've seen the surveys come out, but for me, like I've come in as a general manager and the two areas that I'm most excited about doing innovations and getting involved are customer support and sales. Obviously sales because selling with love, but I do like this idea of proximity because I find when I go and speak to the customers, I get to see the customer support tickets. I get to see what the sales conversations are about. I get to speak to the people who have just become clients. That gives me data that I can't feel in a survey. And do you have a lot that you speak about just the act of connecting with other humans actually being such a good quality to have if you're leading an organization and you're repeating do that?
Oh, yeah. Look, I like to kind of shake around the threat of AI showing up and everyone's going to lose their jobs because AI is going to do everything. And then point out that, by the way, humans who consume need humans. You probably have written extensively about this and experienced this with Selling with Love is, you know, when someone wants to make a tough decision or important decision, they need another human to validate the decision. A lot of times, it's not even about convince me that I should get it. It's about tell me that I'm thinking about this the right way. And when you have these decisions where even if a robot spit out the answer that says, this is the right call, we did the math for you, blah, 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 you're not going to close as much business. You're not going to connect as much. And then the experience for the individual who went through a no touch, you're not going to generate any loyalty. You're not going to generate any passion to kind of come back or evangelism out of a person who's had this experience. So what I advise, especially when it comes down to proximity is, you know, get data. Data's great, but remember that you've got more context. You'll always have more context than a survey. The survey can't tell you how people feel when they're going through the process. They can't give you the empathy that you really need to make the right calls. Instead, what a survey does is it kind of gives you numbers around potentially preconceived notions, and it gives you some statistics that are, again, what people want to tell you, not how people feel or will do it when the heat is on. So an example where I was trying to dig into why would the Florida nail salons be struggling with business during the COVID pandemic while the California nail salons weren't. I thought it would be the exact opposite because you've got these strict policies in California and you don't have the strict policies in Florida. And when I looked at what was going on with California, it was pretty consistent. Revenue dipped, but costs came down and they were all implementing social distancing very consistently. And the cost came down because they just didn't have as many, you know, workers in the salon. They kind of did a bunch of cuts and they kind of tried to manage. But then I saw in Florida, you got a whole bunch of them that just really struggled. And what they did was they stayed open. They kept everybody and not enough people came in. But I saw a couple in my data that seemed to be doing okay. So I called one of them to say, hey, so like, what was the deal? Like, why were you able to kind of survive? How did you get all those customers in to come in and stay? She's like, oh, no, no. I just understood my customers. They were nervous about coming in. We were in a mall. There's another nail salon in the same mall. And we know that some folks, especially the ones who come to us, are worried about the virus. And so we told them we're going to have masks. We told them we're doing social distancing. We didn't go over and above and like do a whole bunch of things, but we did at least communicate that we were going to do more than what we were being forced to do by the government. And she kind of downsized her staff a little bit. She got a bunch of people out so that she could collect some PPP lending on the ones that she kept, put the rest of them on. There's some federal unemployment assistance. So she got the other ones taken care of in the meantime. And her customers just came in consistently and her business was consistent because none of them were too worried about it. And then the other place, which she said was it used to be packed and all the folks in there were waiting all the time and they still got, you know, half or a little bit more than half of the customers they normally get. But the other half stayed at home because they just didn't feel comfortable. So where are you going to get that? You're not going to get that from survey data. You're going to get that because you know your community, because you've been talking to people, because you've said, hey, I'm worried. What do you think I should do? Right? Having a much closer connection to your customers lets you make those decisions. And by the way, there's no time to go run a survey when stuff like that's happening. You got to go by what you really perceive your customers want. So to me, that was really interesting. It's like, wow, okay. So she made decisions based on her intuition and what she knew about her customers and actually saved her business.
Well, I love the fact that a good intuition usually is informed by unconscious data we pick up from the proximity, right? Like I find a good intuition is not done in isolation.
It's not magic. You actually have to talk to people. You have to listen. You have to care what they care about. So proximity isn't just, hey, you're standing next to a customer. Or, you know, a lot of owners, they don't stand next to their customers. They need to then talk to their employees about what customers are doing. They need to ask other people's opinions. So why do you think they turned around after they looked at the menu? Sometimes you actually learn something. You know, the person at the desk is like, yeah, everybody who sees that they look at the price, they pick this thing and, you know, they see it and they don't want to come here because there's another restaurant down the street that has this. Oh, wow. Shoot. All I have to do is change the price on one item and we will get more customers. Yeah. You don't learn that just by standing around. Like you actually have to ask the people around you who talk to your customers or see the customers or walk the route east instead of the route west into the restaurant, right? All these things come up that you just don't know unless you ask.
So Sri, with this, you speak about, you know, listening to the employees, and I want to speak particularly about the leadership team. As you're trying to find the right positioning and putting yourself into a growth stage, you have other leaders and people that have different perspectives. And if you're coming in as, say, CEO or general manager, at the end of the day, you have to make a decision. How do you weigh in people's opinions on the leadership team? And do you find that certain departments should carry more weight based on their proximity?
Decisions are tough. Everybody looks to the owner because they're accountable, right? Everyone looks to the management. And most people who don't have ownership or like the upside, they don't want to be accountable for anything if they don't have to. And they'd love to give it to somebody else. I love the idea of the principles in that you can use them to help people make simpler decisions because they will know that if they meet these principles, they follow these principles, then the decisions will automatically align. Now, I don't particularly have a framework for kind of decision matrices. If it was a big business, yes, you know, you can create these matrices and you can say, hey, what decisions are you accountable for, responsible for? You know, where in the organization do we cut off saying this is too big for you, we need to move it up? In the small business, what I love to go and espouse is the owner first needs to really feel good about the principles. And so I want them to be able to write it out and talk about it and understand it. And it's not as simple as just, you know, writing a mission statement, right? Or writing a positioning description. It really is, you know, confront the questions of like, which customers are the ones I serve? Which ones are the ones who, you know, can also use my product? And which are the customers I don't really want? Like knowing that, being able to describe them to yourself first, right? And be able to describe what makes you special or unique, even if it's something as simple as, look, I'm a pizza place. I got New York style pizza. And while I know there's seven others out there, I'm the only one in this neighborhood, right? Knowing that, saying it out loud and confronting reality gives everybody a sense of, okay, well, now we know who we are, right? We know who we are. The owner knows who we are. The individuals in the business say, this is important, right? The fact that we're New York, the fact that we're this location, knowing and understanding that positioning gives them a lot more context and the right core to make a decision if they had to make a decision, right? Or purpose is probably just as important. You know, if your purpose in the business is, yes, I want to make money, but I also want to introduce let's say your Ethiopian restaurant. I want to introduce Ethiopian cuisine. I want people to know and learn about it and embrace it and evangelize it to their friends. Well, your wait staff, when they understand that's really what your vision is, it's not just to make a buck on the food, but to get the people to understand the food and to know where its history is and all that. Great. Now they're going to get on board. And then the decisions of maybe you do have a nice restaurant where you've got a front of house head. He's going to say, well, I want to add more history on this. I want to go and do a little bit more of a spiel on it, right? When you're going to your person who's going to design your menu, they'll be thinking about, well, how do I do more education with it? Because you've decided on that purpose. You've talked about it. People around you understand it. So focusing in on the principles is really helpful because you can't give everybody all the tools they need to make every decision the way they want to. But if you give them the core logic for what holds you together, right? What makes the decisions make sense, they can actually go and execute a lot better. They have a clear vision of what we're trying to accomplish. They have a clear vision of who you are as a business. You hear it in larger companies too. You talk about corporate strategy. You talk about, oh, like, what are we trying to get to? What's our value prop? And again, all that gets embraced down into lots of detail with lots of work behind it, data, numbers, profitability. Small business, you don't need it. You don't have the time for that. But you do want to reflect those values, those principles really clearly in your decisions. Then the team recognizes and understands it. And they know, oh, wait, look, that's a customer who's really just the to-go kind of customer. We have the business for the to-go customers. But we really make sure that we've got the seats for the customers to come in and sit and drink and sip their lattes or drink their coffee in-house because that's who we cater to, right? And knowing that means the decisions that your folks make will be more aligned with what you would want than based on some profit motive or any other motives.
Sri, right at the beginning of the conversation, you mentioned about your own style of leadership and you talk about servant leadership. And I'm wondering if that's just one of the many ways you can be a leader, or is that just a better way of being a leader?
If you read the book, it's the way to be a better leader, right? I don't know. I think there's other ways to kind of get people. It depends on what you're trying to do, right? If you're trying to blaze a path, you're trying to go down some way of business or create some new route, I don't know that servant leadership is the first model. And I think you have to be entrepreneurial. You have to be challenging. You have to set big aspirations and goals, right? Which is a little different than, you know, a lot of the mechanisms that you'd read about in servant leadership. So it's not that they're not both applicable, but there's been times for me where leadership was really about getting people to rally around a big goal or kind of a new vision and empowering them to kind of go and help and execute it. I mean, there's others around, I got to create a sense of urgency, and it didn't feel very servant-like at all where, you know, folks have to act, they have to make some tough decisions, and you're not going to get that same, you know, you get to go be you and I'll support you. It's, we've got to change what you're doing and I got to hold you to it.
I've actually heard a concept with my previous employment, which the CEO's name was Vishen Lakhiani. He used a model, and I don't know if he borrowed it from somewhere else. I assume he did. It was like a difference between a wartime and peacetime CEO. Is that kind of also the balance that you play?
Maybe. I definitely can relate to wartime and peacetime. There's definitely, I can find myself in both of those scenarios. I wonder. I think there's an adventure time, and there's delivery time, right, as well. Like, maybe they're the same, maybe there's different. Like sometimes you just got potential and you're going to chase it and you're worried about like, how do I get to the best I can be? And there's other times where it's like, look, hey, I signed up to do some things. I've got either shareholders, stakeholders, et cetera, that need to get us where we need to get to. So let's get organized and focused. I don't want to say that's wartime. Wartime could really be, hey, something, hey, look, I went through this. When COVID hit us, we were at our peak in terms of lending, we had tons of money outstanding sitting in the hands of a ton of small businesses. And I knew we weren't getting it back, right? We knew it was coming back, or at least not quickly. So we were in trouble. And it was, all right, well, batten down the hatches, shut everything you can down. And it was survival time, right? So I've seen survival time, I've seen hope time. I guess when it gets down to getting something done, you have to contextualize what the mission is, right? So maybe it's always wartime. What's the mission? What are you trying to accomplish? Who's the best suited for it? But the couple of things I would say don't change, you always have to have a vision. Where are we going, right? What are we trying to deliver? And you can't expect everybody to know all the details on how the business operates and how they're supposed to make decisions, but you can convey some meaningful direction. Sometimes people call it a North Star. In the world of small business, I want it to be your three principles. Like, really get good on those three principles. And as your team knows and understands that, when the context changes, when it starts to rain real hard, or when, you know, the lightning comes out and you've got to change, people get it. And then they can kind of come back to, well, what's important to us? Like, what are the principles about this business? I'm going to go and make sure I deliver on those until I get kind of any better orders, right?
I'd want to make sure that there's a clear distinction about how to be a good servant leader versus allowing yourself to be a pushover. Because I think that could be a misconception that someone would assume from being a servant leader, which means you just get, I don't know, abused by your team. How do you make sure that somebody who takes this advice is applying it the right way?
So, you know, in leading a team, you know, I've had a lot of, you know, good opportunities, and I've also had a lot of learnings, right? When I got thrown in to being a manager the first time at McKinsey, I didn't get that it was me supposed to be helping my team do better. I thought it was me telling my team how to do their job. And, you know, I like to describe, if you're doing servant leadership right, you have a goal and you're trying to accomplish a goal and you're not sitting there taking, you know, bad work as a good answer. What you're doing is you're trying to face your team in the right direction so that you can accomplish whatever that goal is. And most of the time, if you're in this, what I would call kind of a good servant mode, they are facing in the right direction and you're just supplying them and giving them what they need to go in that direction. But if you're supplying them and you're not pointing them in the right direction, or you're not anticipating their next move and where they're going to head, yeah, then you're a pushover, right? They're out there. They're not going towards the target that you're trying to get them to. They're not marching down the path that's going to be the one that gets you to success. You can't keep feeding them and supplying them until you correct where they're facing. You know, you've got to get them lined up to the right place. And, you know, each one of those things is different in every context, but like, you believe in the vision? Great. Do they understand it and they believe in it too? Great. Do they have the skills to figure out and to read the compass? Am I going in the right direction or not? They may not, right? You may need to be the one who reads the compass to them. Or, you know, some people might think of that as micromanaging, but if you're micromanaging, right, it means that the team that you're working with doesn't understand either the direction you want them to go or doesn't have the tools to go in the direction on their own. So go fix those things. Don't micromanage.
Sri, I'd be curious to know, your book just came out. We're going to put a link for everybody in the show notes to go and grab a copy. If you're in a small business role, maybe you're just getting started, or you have a leadership team under you, there are great principles that I'd want you to go and discover even more than what we've talked about here. But I'd be curious to know, from your perspective, you've taken the time to put together this book, you've stepped out of your comfort zone, and now you are the author of it as well. What is the biggest result you hope to achieve from people picking up this book and making a change?
Really want to encourage more entrepreneurship. I want to encourage more ownership. What I'm most excited about is, as I shared this with many entrepreneurs already, and I've talked to a number of them about kind of the way I'm thinking about things, many people feel more confident in how they're going to run their business afterwards. And when you've got some confidence of what about me can I embrace, and how do I take the things that I know about me and then apply them with some semblance of business strategy, you get some really exciting opportunities and more opportunities open up. And, you know, go back to like this foreshadowing of the world's kind of changing. Like, big companies are going to grow bigger and get more profitable and eat up more of whatever the business world is. But it turns out they're going to do it with less people. There's going to be a lot more people kind of doing something else. What are they going to do? Mostly they're going to be in businesses that are smaller, serving other people. And there's going to be a lot more jobs that are purely about human-to-human relationships. And, you know, that's all we're going to have left, maybe. Or the other way to think about it is, how else are you going to have any business at all? Because the businesses, they serve people, right? So my vision is people can do better as a small business owner who are focused on their particular purpose and their particular positioning, right? With their particular proximity to their customers. You get more of them, more successful ones, more robust ones, and more resilient businesses all across the country, all across the world, because you're doing something that you care about and passionate about. It may not be massive, but the scale guys are running a whole different play now, right? And don't run that play. Don't get caught up. Maybe somebody wants to create a unicorn company, go for it. My book's not for the unicorns. My book is for somebody who's like, I want to run something that I'm proud of, that I feel great about, that's going to take care of my family, and something that's going to leave a mark on a number of people who will enjoy what I'm doing. I think so many more people can do that and should do that going forward.
Well, Sri, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. One of the things I like the most about what you're teaching is in a world where there maybe is a lot of overwhelm of information, you're actually giving a tool for people to trust themselves more and have that confidence, be a bit more focused on which opinions actually will matter, which could come from proximity of customers, employees, and how to actually filter out some of the noise of the advice that might not apply to them at all. And so if anybody's having a sense of overwhelm in business and you want to be able to have a lot more of that trust in yourself and how to operate, I would definitely recommend you pick up a copy of Unconvention, a small business strategy guide, and it'll give you a chance to focus on what matters, get your purpose right, and make sure that you're positioning yourself correctly and having success in the process. The podcast was formerly known Selling with Love, and a question I'd love to ask all my guests on that was, what does selling with love mean to you? I'd love to ask that to you as well.
Selling with love means you believe in and care about what you're offering somebody. To me, you know, that's one of the places that I kind of really cut my teeth in being a good executive was, if you have a product that you believe in, you're going to be fine. You just have to go and put the time in to understand which customers actually believe in it too and helping them see that. If you have a product that you don't believe in, or if you have a product that you don't care if somebody actually uses it or not and all you care about is the money, don't be in that business. Just don't be in that business, right? You can make money. I know there's a lot of people who make money. I call it making money on arbitrage, like picking up pennies. There's pennies out there, right? There's ways to get to squeeze out some bucks. That's a business model. I don't think they're sustainable business models. I don't think they're fulfilling business models. But, you know, who am I to judge? I'm not going to do them. But if you want to do one of those, great. That's not selling with love. Selling with love is actually convincing somebody to do something that you would do yourself because you believe in it. If you were in their situation, you may not buy the product yourself because it doesn't apply to you, but you have to believe in it's going to be good for them.
That is a beautiful answer. I love it. Sri Kaza, thank you so much for taking the time, sharing your wisdom. All the best on your tour. And I'm glad to have been a supporter to bring your message to the world. I do think it's a great message, and we're excited that you brought this work together.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for being a supporter.
Thank you for listening to the Jason Mark Campbell Business Podcast. And of course, keep selling with love.
Life is unpredictable, but preparing for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. They offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to policygenius.com. That's policygenius.com.